The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis. This is Music Weekly. This week, a slightly different programme than normal. Your team of reviewers look at this year's Guardian Album of the Year list. And joining me to do that are the cream of the Guardian's music scene. Tim Jones.
Hello. Hello. How are you doing?
Rebecca Nicholson.
Hi.
And Kitty Empire.
Hi there.
Thank you. And myself, of course. Just to explain how today will work, we'll start off with the bottom of the list. At the end of the programme, we'll add some thoughts on what we each think should have been in the top 50 but wasn't. And in the middle, our main course, we more detailed discussion of the top 10. But we'll take the first 40 in chunks of 10. So here's some highlights from 50 to 41. The Album of the Year list opens with Ice Age and New Brigade at 50, followed by, at 49, The Antlers and Burst Apart. 48, Ryan Adams, Ashes and Fire. 47, True Window, As High as the Highest Heavens and From the Centre to the Circumference of the Earth. Thank you. 46, Beirut, Riptide. 45, In with a Bullet, Colin Stetson, New History Warfare Volume 2, Judges. No way is this a really rock critique-y list of albums. Mind you, wait till we get to the top, we'll be laughing on the other side of our faces. 44, Marius Nezet, Golden Explosion. 43, one for the headbangers, Machine Head, Unto the Locust. That's a proper title for a record, isn't it? Unto the Locust. 42, Nils Frahm and Felt. 41, Shabazz Palaces, Black Up. Team, any favourites from this list? Have you indeed actually heard of any of the records in this part of the list? Because I'm not going to lie to you, I'm struggling.
I think everyone can agree that Colin Stetson's New History Warfare Volume 2, Judges, wasn't quite as good as Volume 1.
What was Volume 1 about?
Jury.
Yeah. Kitty, you're a fan of Ice Age, I believe.
I think we need to talk about punk rock. I think Spin magazine in America voted Fucked Up as their album of the year,
yep.
Which I think is a very polemical yet interesting choice. I'm surprised Ice Age is so far down the list. They've had a lot of love this year, a lot of critical blog love. I wouldn't say I play this album constantly, but I have to say when I did play it, I thought this is... It gets post-hardcore in there. It gets Joy Division in there. It gets a lot of kind of Nordic angst that is terribly of the moment. They're from Copenhagen.
Oh, I suppose they're, yes, very timely. Yes,
any fan of The Killing knows that Copenhagen's mean streets are pretty mean.
Oh.
So there's a sort of Nordic ennui there, I think, that I responded to.
Marvellous. Nice to see some metal, I think, in the Guardian. You know, it's got to be said, not often in Critics List, unless it's in Metal Hammer or something like that, do you get some... I think we have friend of the pod, Dom Lawson, to thank for Machine Head's high play... Well, you know, placing in this. But it's good, a varied thing. Also, Shabazz Palaces, good to see. And I think that's a really, really good album. In a year when hip-hop has been dominated in Britain, at least, by the pop end of things, it's good to see sort of a bit of lyrical thoughtfulness.
I got to review that at some length and thoroughly enjoyed doing it. I don't know if any of you have actually seen the final finished product, but it comes in a sort of velvety box with sparkly writing on it.
Wow. Like Odessa by the Bee Gees, the 1969 concept album.
Which, at the risk of sounding hugely superficial, I really liked. It's influenced by jazz. It's influenced by all manner of strange things that... I think hip-hop is at its best when it's not just straight-up gangster, perhaps. Sonically, yes. It used to be a very inventive genre. Now, occasionally, with the pop rap, you do get a bit bored of hearing the same.
There is a lot of that stuff about... I mean, you know, the fair play... Very much behind British talent getting in the charts, and very much behind, you know, a genre that people used to really look down on or special plead for, not needing either of those things to happen because it's basically become the mainstream of pop music. But dear God, there is a lot of music that sounds like the sort of record that would have got played in Gatecrasher in 1999 in the charts. It's like, I don't think I can cope with another Calvin Harris produced sort of vague rave anthem with lyrics about being in the VIP over the top of it. And
because even at the time, I used to be quite into that music and go to those clubs.
But did you?
I used to have neon face paint.
Sorry, I've knocked my microphone over. Were you a Crasher kid? Did you have like a Mitsubishi logo?
I had green and orange hair.
Did you? You're making this up.
Not making up. I didn't ever listen to the music outside of, like, the night.
But sure.
We used to, like, yeah, go to Sheffield on a coach and...
You're joking.
I hope there are pictures of this.
Oh, man, this is amazing.
Pictures, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
We were
knowing of it. We were laughing about
it. Oh, yeah, yeah, you say that now.
Yeah, yeah.
I bet you weren't knowing of it at 4 o'clock in the morning.
No.
Hugging everybody. This
but
is pretty
even
well.
At the time, even when you were kind of in the middle of the dance floor, like, at your peak, you weren't thinking... I hope this music stays around for...
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. Judge Jules. This man is making a staying entry in the annals of pop and rock history.
But it's funny that that's taken off in America. You wouldn't have thought that that kind of music would be so huge there.
There's always been this massive thing that synthesizers are European and possibly sexually suspect. And yet now we find thuggish hip-hop and R&B being massively influenced by European dance music.
Mm. I think actually WTF. There's a sense in which a lot of those... European DJs that have got, like David Guetta, like Swedish House Mafia, actually sell themselves in a way that's very, very understandable to a rapper or to an R&B star, because it's all about this kind of bling lifestyle. Yeah, like, you know, David Guetta's club is called Fuck Me, I'm Famous. Mm. You know, it's
the actual freedom of that music, to an extent, is just not really what's been replicated. It's the actual the sonics of it, isn't it? But the actual kind of real, genuine release doesn't seem to be part of it. So it's very kind of... Yeah. It's put together in a lab, isn't it?
So, yes, and that's not true, bringing the discussion back to the actual Guardian list. It's not
Shabazz
true the Shabazz Palaces album.
It is not like
It's also not true of Cat's Eyes.
Cat's Eyes, or indeed Colin Stetson's New History Warfare Volume 2 Judges. I don't think anybody could accuse that of sounding like music that was played at Gatecrasher. We'll continue up the list with numbers 40 to 31.
Just put your paws up, because you were born this way, baby.
Some of the tracks in the next section of the list there, starting off at number 40 with Grafrisa's Hotel Shampoo, followed by, at 39, The Streets, Computers and Blues, 38, Nicola Roberts, Cinderella's Eyes, 37, Kanye West and Jay-Z, Watch the Throne, 36, Pistol Annies, Hell on Heels, 35, Cat's Eyes, 34, Jamie Woon, Mirror Writing, 33, Destroyer, Kaput, 32, Licky Lee, Wounded Rhymes, and 31, Lady Gaga, Born This Way. So that's a very diverse list of stuff. You've got Nicola Roberts at one extreme. I guess people will be, I mean, people looking on the blog, people have been surprised to see everything. It seemed to be just
music.
Astonished,
yeah.
That, you know, absolutely anything, anything that's in the list is in the list. But they seem particularly to have been surprised by Nicola Roberts.
It's a difficult sell, I think. She's the least, probably the least famous member of Girls Aloud. And she's made an album with Metronomy and Dragonette and people like that.
Mm. I'd have thought that made it more of a sell for the girl.
Do you think?
It's almost like a link to credibility. That
well, that's
maybe they
true.
Need.
But so also it's... I feel like that's been oversold a little bit, that she's done a song with Metronomy, so therefore she's indie and cool. I think actually it's a very straightforward pop album, and it's a very good one. And lyrically, it's funny. There's a line on there about giant balls and KY jelly. Which,
amazing.
You know, I didn't expect.
No,
I was listening to it, and
I wasn't listening closely enough. I mostly listened to the production.
Yeah.
Giant Bulls and KY Jelly.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Which is very funny. I just think it's a very weird pop album, but also a very good one.
I think it's interesting that out of all the members of Girls Aloud, she's the one that's ended up carrying the sort of torch for the sound of Girls Aloud when Girls Aloud were
she
amazing.
She did co-write a lot of those. She did co-write with Xenomania.
Yeah, but let's be brutal. I think the co-writing process with Xenomania, I don't think it was Lennon and McCartney, I don't think it was eyeball to eyeball.
I like the idea.
Sat on a piano. but wouldn't it be amazing if it had been? But I mean, it's interesting. No, there's definitely a sense with that pop music, like R&B to a degree, has lost some of the sense of, you know, edginess that it had a few years ago, that you don't really get people making records like Biology by Girls Aloud in the same way that you don't get Rihanna doesn't make R&B records that sound like We Need a Resolution by Aaliyah. And something's maybe lost, and maybe you can find it on that Nicola Roberts album. Talking about weird pop records, I want to big up Kaput by Destroyer, which in some ways is one of my favourite, well, it's not in some ways, it is one of my favourite albums of the year. Just a sort of brilliant collection of really quite moving songs in a lot of ways, I think, about being a music fan in a kind of isolated and wistful way. I get the impression from the album that he grew up kind of surrounded by people who were like, yeah, man, Van Halen! And what he really liked was weird 80s sort of prog pop, like David Sylvian and Avalon by Roxy Music and things like that. We're surrounded by these guys going, yeah, Def Leppard rules! You know, you suck balls, man! And it's this sort of amazing love letter of an album to that kind of music. And I love the way that it's completely... It's so... But a lot of music influenced by sort of smooth 80s sounds, AOR, that kind of thing this year. But most of it has been done through this sort of mitigating gauze of being a bit lo-fi or warping it in some way. And this just totally wholeheartedly embraces that sound. It's covered in sax solos and, you know, the sound of the woo of a fretless bass and all that kind of thing. And I just found it a totally lovely, warm, endearing, brilliant pop record. But it's not a bit of ironic hipster posturing. It's just I think it's a really heartfelt, amazing album. I love it to death.
Is it surprising to see Lady Gaga in the chart, or is it surprising to see her so far down as 31? What are people's takes on that?
I think that the least interesting thing about Lady Gaga is the music she makes.
Have you always thought that?
Yes.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't think it was all that when I first heard the first album. And I think the sort of way she presents herself and all that is brilliant and amazing. She's kind of, in some ways, the most interesting pop star around. But, you know, she's made some great singles, really brilliant singles. You know, Paparazzi's brilliant single. But it's just... doesn't make that good album.
No, I think I became an absolutely huge fan at the time of Bad Romance. That's the track that kind of did it for quite a lot of us, I think. And this kind of rock, open road type sound, sort of Blaze of Glory type posturing that she's doing here, which is she's kind of retrenching from the sort of dance music and kind of going for kind of almost Bruce Springsteen feel, which I just kind of think is a bit...
But I think, in fairness, she's doing that in quite a deliberate way. Mm. In it is, you know, an album that's sort of fairly explicitly concerned with, you know, it's all right to be gay, and doing that in a way that's trying to sort of take it to the mainstream American heartlands of, you know, it's actually quite a balls. I think that's, you know, something that doesn't make any sense over here because we don't really care.
But I don't think that album's, I think the album's like that in parts, and You and I is fairly dreadful. And obviously Born This Way, I don't think works quite as well over here as it does there. But a lot of that album is real kind of tops off, arms in the air. Berlin seedy sex club.
And that's the stuff I like.
Exactly, that's the stuff I like. But I think that hasn't quite been... I really like Judas. I was surprised that that didn't do better. I thought that was a fantastic song.
It's really weird thing because I got the impression this album hadn't really done as well as the last album. And then you look at the sales figures, it's just sold 50 squillion records.
But she sold it in the States. She sold it for a while for something ridiculously cheap.
But, I mean, you know, a success. I interviewed her over the phone. Lady Gaga, and I was really delighted to say she's an incredibly thoughtful, intelligent, smart woman. You don't quite know how it's put together, if it's as clever as it thinks it is, and da-da-da-da-da-da. And she was really newer stuff. She's really newer stuff about performance art and stuff like that. I was hugely impressed. And also she said I had a nice voice. so there you go.
You're easily bought.
So let's move on from Lady Gaga to Licky Lee.
I am extremely fond of Licky Lee's Wounded Rhymes. I'm shocked it's so low. In fact, I have to say, when this came out, I had to tweet. I was so outraged. I suddenly felt like one of those people on the comment section going, I'm outraged. Yes, this... I don't know where you stood on Licky Lee before, but she was this kind of baby-voiced, kind of Lolita-esque, Nordic, kind of sort of dance pop, kind of melancholy person. And suddenly she went away and broke up with somebody and went to America and made a girl group album, which is utterly devastated sounding, if that's a word. Those of us who fondly recall Back to Black by Amy Winehouse and liked the girl group bits, there's plenty here to savour. I don't want to go out on a limb and say it's the sequel to Back to Black that you've not heard of, but it is.
It's a great album. I completely agree. Rich Kid Blues, I think, is a fantastic track.
It came out very early, didn't it,
yeah,
in the year, so I wonder if that's why it's so low down, because people's memories are short.
Yeah, that's very true. Okay, well, next then, the albums between 30 and 21. And at 30 on the list is Gil Scott-Heron and Jamie XX's We're New Here.
Pass away, that it ends. Though there was a time when he and I were friends. I'll shake myself into your pocket, invisible to what you. So and what you don't have now will come back again. You got heart and you go in your own way.
Following Gil Scott-Heron and Jamie XX at 30, it's 29, Kate Bush, 50 Words for Snow. 28, Jonathan Wilson, Gentle Spirit. 27, Radiohead, The King of Limbs. 26, Gang Gang Dance, Eye Contact. 25, Kurt Vile, Smoke Ring for My Halo. 24, Feist, Metals. 23, Laura Marling, A Creature I Don't Know. 22, Noah and the Whale, Last Night on Earth. 21, Gillian Welch, The Harrow and the Harvest. Now, I believe, Kitty, Gillian Welch was your favourite album of the year.
It was. I kept coming back to it and back to it and back to it in that kind of... You sort of sit down and ask yourself, okay, not what makes me look good on my list, but what is it that I literally have played to death? And I've played that album in cars, on public transport, in my house. You know, it's so easy on the ear, which and so lyrically devastating as well. I think that they've got this bluegrassy country noir thing down to a T. It's been a long time waiting for an album from them. It's been sort of, I don't know, 8 years, I think it was. And those of us who are big Gillian Welch fans were like, oh God, what's happened? Have they broken up? You know, what's going on? But apparently it was writer's block, which I think, you know, is hardly glamorous. But I think they're such perfectionists. I know someone who went to interview them in Nashville, and they literally have, they triangulate the positions of microphones by some kind of strange system, and they cover everything in plastic so it doesn't move.
Wow.
And they're very, very, very anal retentive, and I like that in a band.
We're starting to get into sort of the more standardly critically acclaimed.
I'm pleased Radiohead didn't get any higher than that.
I think that's a good album.
Do you?
I think it's one can't stand him, really? Yeah. Why can't you stand him?
That's not controversial, is it?
Like, no, those people said that, but I mean, we can't stand it, really.
I mean, there's not a single tune on it. And
side
just,
two's really good.
I wouldn't know how you. I like their last record, and I thought maybe they've started to realise that putting the odd tune in is not a bad idea. But then this came out, I just thought, they're seen as like this kind of adventurous, bold band, but they've been making the same record to me over and over again now, and it's like,
interesting.
You know, the first four records were all completely different, and it was quite interesting seeing where they go next, but it just feels like they've settled in, and you know the next one's going to sound the same as well. Don't know.
You don't know that. Next album might sound like
Licky Lee.
I was going to say, what's his name?
Colin Stetson.
Colin Stetson. Noah and the Whale. It's a surprise, surely a surprise entry.
It's amusing that Laura Marling and Noah and the Whale are next to each other. I think she's very fed up of having him follow her around.
Say the case in real life. Huh? I'm quite surprised that Noah and the Whale album. I mean, I was quite surprised it did as well as it did, to be honest, because it seems to be never out of the charts. There's a bit of tour continually Noah and the Whale. Maybe that had something to do with it. I mean, I think it's a good album and everything. I think it's good sort of pop songs, but it just didn't strike me as the kind of thing that would float. Do we know why it got
this? Mumford Effect?
It has nothing like Mumford Effect.
Just because I counted up the vote, so I know a bit of the kind of the workings of how it all got put together. I think Noah the Whale was one of the ones with two or three people. It was their favourite album of the year,
really?
But no one else really voted
really?
For it. It was one of those.
Who was that? Who's favourite album?
Well, I imagine, I don't know this, but I think Laura Barton's a fan, and I think there's certain other writers who are just big fans.
Well, there you go. Okay, well, let's move on, because we've got a lot of stuff to cover. Before we move into the top 10 on the list, tracks 20 to 11.
Sips of water, the record lies unbroken, and no doubt it's white flour in my diet. It's going to be the death of me. Sweet drum roll for those embittered big ideas.
So, the list from 20 to 11 is number 20, Fleet Foxes, Helplessness Blues. Number 19, Drake, Take Care. Number 18, St. Vincent with Strange Mercy. Number 17, Björk, Biophilia. Number 16, The Horrors with Skying. Number 15, Subtract with Subtract. Number 14, Tom Waits, Bad As Me. Number 13, King Creosote and John Hopkins, Diamond Mine. Number 12, Wild Beast with Smother. Number 11, White Denim. White Denim?
White Denim are popular on The Guide.
The Guide,
yeah.
Pretty much The Guide.
That's
all down to The Guide.
Don't blame me for this. But, yeah.
If I could briefly defend White Denim.
So the album's called D, by the way. Yes, let's. No, I do sort of like White Denim. I do sort of like them. Well, do like Wind Rush.
I think without getting too far ahead of ourselves, I think it's fidgety, edgy, quirky music for people. People who like Four to the Floor will not appreciate their crazy prog jazz, you know, spaz punk leanings.
All of those words give me the cold sweats.
Me too. Me too. I agree. I hate overcomplicated music, and yet White Denim are fundamentally at heart a very, very good punk band. And I couldn't tell you what their songs are about. Don't listen to the lyrics. Just enormously complex, intricate music that you can actually nod along to. Very, very good record. They actually put another one out this year. This is probably slightly better, if you're splitting hairs.
Well, there you go. But I wasn't knocking White Denim as a band. I was just surprised it was as high as it was. I mean, you know, I sort of appreciate what they do. It's kind of not for me. It's a bit sort of tricksy or whatever. And a little bit, a touch of that kind of wacky thing about it as well. You're crazy guys. But, I mean, I can see why people like it. Surprised it was that high. Sorry, Subtract. Okay. You like Subtract, do you too?
I did. I actually voted it for my album of the year.
Gosh.
A lot of people have dismissed it as a coffee table album, which you always get, you hear, don't you? People say, oh,
such a dickhead's complaint.
I know, it really does.
Tricky. Coffee table music. I wasn't really that. Anything with like a tricky album. It's like, what kind of dinner parties do you have? There's exactly. Coffee, you put the horrible kind of satanic music from Bristol. Anyway, carry on.
I mean, I think Subtract is basically, he's obsessed with various strands of modern dance music. So he's weave them all. It's almost the worst word you could ever use, but it's a very intelligent album. Which I know.
Is it eclectic?
It's very eclectic and intelligent. But it's one of those things that you can put your headphones on and hear different intricacies in the rhythms.
That's good.
That is good. But what actually makes it for me is that the vocalists on it, there's the kind of different vocalists he uses, and Sampha's on it with this brilliant kind of hurt. She just sounds wounded. So I just really like it for that, really.
Do you think that there's a little part of you that's still on the dance floor at Gatecrasher, and that's why you like this sort of thing?
I don't know, because I just don't really relate it to the dance floor. It's a bit like all those kind of Rusty and Zombie records in the sense.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? There's a sort of disjunction, I think, between
it's
a lot of
that palette of sounds, but not really to make something particularly danceable. Although, you know, it's got quite a bit of two-step element to it, which is kind of lightly funky.
Well, Jesse Ware's on there as well, isn't he? And Jesse Ware and Sampha together, without Subtract, did one of my favourite songs of the year, which
was
Valentine.
Oh, which we had on the singles club.
Oh, did I? Yeah, maybe. Really lovely, lovely song.
I'm pleased to see, it's probably my two favourite albums of the year, Skying by the Horrors and King Creosote and John Hopkins' Diamond Mine. I think the Horrors album's brilliant. I love the fact the Horrors have gone from being this kind of joke to being this sort of amazing, forward-looking, like Mojo's band of the year. Who would have predicted that when the Horrors first appeared? They are, you know, I've said this before, they're sort of proper music fans, but they don't seem to be high. It's not record collection rock. They bring something else to it, despite
the fact. Someone who was that obsessed with a record collection and someone whose first album didn't show any signs, particularly of great songwriting talent, you would think there'd be no hope, really. But
yeah,
actually,
absolutely. It's completely the opposite. Yeah. That was the thing that sometime contributor to the pod, Pete Perfidis, said in his review of the first album. He's like, this is basically rubbish, but their taste is so good that I think they might do something, you know, I think they might do something amazing. And there's an element of that if you sort of meet them.
And that's Faris's second album in the top 50.
Yeah, I know. Again, who would have thought? Mm. Faris Badwin, musical auteur. And also King Creosote and John Hopkins. I came to that album quite late.
That's another coffee table album, is it? That gets
coffee table, my ass. That's a really emotionally wrenching.
Yeah, yeah.
Completely. I was making the kids breakfast the first time I listened to it, and the last song in particular, which is called "Your Young Voice," which is about his kids, I think, just completely winded me. It's just got one
weeping into the wind.
I was sobbing into the Cheerios. No, it's just one line repeated over and over again. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant record. And you know, King Creosote is not an artist I've really paid. It just makes too many records, King Creosote. Nobody's got enough quality control, I think, to keep making, you know, 55 albums a year or whatever, and they'll all be good.
Could I briefly stick up for Biophilia as well? Because I didn't think that was a very immediate album, and a lot of people have said that it doesn't really have any tunes on it, but it's something that I've kept coming back to over the year, and now I very much love.
I thought it was a good album. I thought it was probably the hoo-ha about the app and all that kind of thing actually distracted from the music a little bit, which is a shame. Anyway, that's enough. As Jimmy Savile once said, you don't get much further outside of the top 10 than number 11. So let's move on to the top 10. These are the top 10 albums of the year as chosen by the Guardian's music team.
Crosses call out, no, no, free. Only John, take a care of what I like you. Fading, falling down.
Ask me, but all my wisdom be parted. Tell me, but all my wisdom be parted. But oh, please, at least answer me this. Answer me, answer me. What's the business, yeah? Don't take my life away, don't take my life away.
Okay, number 10, Tune Yards with Who Killed. Number 9, Rusty, Glass Swords. Number 8, The Weeknd, House of Balloons. Number 7, Metronomy, The English Riviera. Number 6, James Blake by James Blake. Brings us up to the top 5. Number 5, Bon Iver by Bon Iver. So what do we want to talk about from this list? What do we want to, what do we want to pick out? I like The Weeknd. I like James Blake. I thought James Blake's album was very avant-garde, strange thing to get presented in the way it did. Is like, it's going to be the sound of 2012. It's like, no, it's not.
I'm not a fan of James Blake.
You're not?
No,
you don't like his amazing vocals?
No, I saw him performing and I tweeted, I think it was the thing I've tweeted that's been the most retweeted, but I said it's like, he's like Ross from Friends if Friends was a drama.
Wow.
Which is, to me, that's, I just think, come on. Really?
I'm just not sold on him as a pop star. And
he's a terrible pop star.
I saw him live, but I made an even worse mistake. I saw him live outside at South by Southwest 5 minutes after I saw Odd Future.
Wow.
So there was
someone stage diving from the roof and smashing their nose open, and then him sat on a stool. So
he's terribly tall, and he's leaning over his equipment. He's like 7 foot tall, and he's gangly, and he's leaning over like he looks like a giant ginger spider. But I say that with maximum respect. I think it's one of those albums that everyone again has said Coffee Table, and it's better than Coffee Table, far better than Coffee Table. It's actually, you know, quite sad if you give yourself over to it.
It's very sad. No, I think it's a great. I think it's a brilliant record. I
changed my mind about him when I heard his Joni Mitchell cover.
That's brilliant. I can kiss you. Blubstep. Some people don't.
Which is reasonable.
Yeah, I'm with that.
So anyway, yes. So that's James. What else? What else do we like? Well, we like them all.
I'm the only person who likes Tune Yards, apparently. Here, not in the world.
Having
go for it.
Having praised the jerkiness of White Denim, I can then go up a place and go, God, I hate Tune Yards. It's too jerky.
Right.
I'm sorry, I'm a hypocrite, but for some reason, I like music that's about process rather than finished product, and I think this is too much about process.
It's all process.
It's all process and no tunes.
It's weird, if you see her live, it's so phenomenal what she does live, like absolutely mind-blowing, and she hasn't quite captured
what
it on
record.
What's
she do live? Finally.
It is incredible. She just loops everything live, and
and looks a bit like a Crasher kid. She's got lots of neon face paint and things. So.
And once I think we're detecting a theme.
I just see kind of late 90s trance in it. But yeah, she just builds these amazing kind of quite big sounding compositions just by her own vocal loops and stuff. And it's incredible. And it's really compelling. But then on record, because she's got this lo-fi following, I think she wants to think. She made her first album on a dictaphone, and I think she doesn't want to lose that, whatever that was. But I do think it would help to get a bit of a producer in or something.
The team in front of me have written about three of the top four in the chart, so let's go through those in a bit more detail, starting off with what's at number four.
Appropriately so, Beyonce's 4 is at number 4.
Yeah.
This has been a pleasant week of comment discussion underneath this this list. I think this is an excellent album, and it wasn't particularly well received. No. I don't think at the time people thought it had too many ballads on, but this year has actually, a lot of this year has been about slowing down the pace for all of that David Guetta massive, you know, synthy R&B.
Drake is another example.
Drake, another one. Subtract, I think, is quite slowed down. Yeah. There's a lot of it about, but it's just, it was done so well. As an album, it hangs together. I think there are two songs on it that I don't like. One of them is the horrible ballady one towards the end. I Was Here, and I'm actually not massively keen on Run the World, which was the first single. I think both of those don't really fit with the rest of it, but she's worked with The Dream, she's worked with Frank Ocean, who is at number three in the list, and it just sounds really fresh and current, but also very classy.
I disagree. I don't think it's Beyonce's best album. I think I'd stand by the review that I wrote at the time. I think it's sort of a bit of a retrograde step for I'm not a great fan of big ballads and stuff like that. I think that the reason this has got so high is actually there isn't a great deal of pop music that critics gather round at the moment, and I think this and Katy B, not the Katy B album, which I think is actually brilliant, been beneficiaries of people who like pop music and like R&B gathering around something. In the case of Katy B's album, I think it's really good. In the case of Beyonce's album, I just don't think it's the best thing she's done.
I think maybe Beyonce fans really like this because it's a good album, whereas casual fans would prefer two killer singles and nine tracks of filler because they're not going to get the album anyway.
Yeah, exactly. In a way, I think that's what I Am Sasha Fierce was like. It had a handful of good singles but didn't really hang together as an album, whereas I think this does. And also it goes back to what you were saying, Kitty, which is about which albums do you choose that you have genuinely, you know, do you choose the ones you've genuinely played to death? And
what
I played this to death and I like it more and more the more I play it.
I like Beyonce. I've always liked Beyonce. I've always liked Beyonce. I think in pop I've got this constant bugbear about the women in pop. Are they in charge of their own destiny or not? Are they a terrible victim like Britney Spears, or are they actually co-producing, co-writing? Do they have a say in what's going on? And I do feel, so with Lady Gaga, you know, as you were saying earlier, Alexis, you know, you do get the feeling that she is in charge of her own destiny. She's got a hand in the art, she's got a hand in all of the marketing. You know, you do see a mind at work there. And the more I know about Beyonce, I think her Glastonbury, televised Glastonbury performance, you know, we were hearing that, you know, she was basically art directing it herself. She was going, no, I want the camera there and stuff. And I think the more I hear about Beyonce, the more I like her and respect her as an agent, as well as a singer and a performer.
Anyway, so Beyonce album four, it also contained a track where Beyonce collaborated with the artist in the album of the year, listed at number three. Frank Ocean, Tim, you wrote about this for the website.
I did, indeed.
So, he's an intriguing figure, Frank Ocean. He's a member of Odd Future, but he also writes for Justin Bieber.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, covering your bases.
Instantly, you're quite interested in this guy, aren't you?
Yeah, I would have thought so.
What I liked about it is it just sounded like the arrival of a real kind of fresh, strong-minded talent, and it was like, I don't know, it was just such a fresh album. It just didn't feel like anything. I didn't feel like he was trying to tick boxes or he was trying to fit in with anything. He was like, I'm going to make this music because this is what I want to make. It's basically just pop R&B, isn't it? I think
in America, the men who are in soul R&B tend to be slouchy Akon types, and you get
slouchy, what a great word,
you know, somewhere between smoochy and sloppy and lots of other words. So you do get, they're the lover men, that's their role, and Frank Ocean is most definitely not a lover man. He's very, you know, the lyrics are, you know, quite high quality. So it was very novel hearing someone doing something slightly different within that genre.
Also, all those other sensitive R&B types you talk about, actually they don't come across as very nice people when you get
Chris Brown, he's lovely.
even Drake,
there's a lot of solipsism.
You know, and part of that is their appeal. You know, it's such a kind of honest, open kind of take on things, but you don't walk away thinking, God, I'd like to date those guys. But Frank Ocean seems like a nice, I
seldom have come away from an album by a male R&B star thinking, hey, I'd like to date him. But you know,
I live in hope.
Maybe when Frank Ocean puts his proper album out, maybe I will want to date him. I really liked it. I've got to be honest and put my cards on the table here. I can't really be arsed with Odd Future. For the most part, I'm a 40-year-old father of two. There is no room in my life with some little scroat shouting about raping women. I'm just really not interested. I just think that I gave it a go. Goblin. There's no fucking tunes on it. It's a right racket. And
See, Bastard was a better album. What's interesting with Tyler is not on this list at all, and he was the critical, most hyped thing in the world in March.
Yeah,
and then his album was not even on the list.
I just don't think it's that good an album. I mean, there's nothing on it. Unless you want to delve into the psychology of Tyler, and why is he like this, and why is he saying these things, and da da da. In a kind of way, I guess, like Eminem.
Well, that's what I was hoping for.
The difference is, Eminem's albums chock full of tunes.
Yeah,
this
totally.
Is just it's like an underground hip hop. You know what I mean? It's a tuneless underground hip hop record. I think it's too tough a sell. Whereas I think Frank Ocean's great.
It's interesting as well. I suppose, you know, there's not much debate about pro choice. There's not that much debate about gay marriage in pop. I know Lady Gaga and certain people have talked about it, but I thought it was interesting that he was addressing these issues and doing it quite candidly.
And also like the track that samples Coldplay. That's brilliant.
Yeah, that's good.
That's great. Strawberry Samples, which is actually probably my favourite Coldplay song. Not, as I said, plucked from a very long list of favourite Coldplay songs. but I think it's a really intriguing thing. I think something about... Also interesting about the sort of convergence of a lot of different genres of music into this sort of slightly woozy sound. You hear it with ASAP Rocky and the cloud rap genre. But I mean, there's something very similar to that as there is about Chillwave. And you know what I mean? There seems to be a lot of this sort of woozy, not quite there, that kind of hypnagogic pop thing that's going on.
It is all converging, isn't it?
It is all converging.
Spreading across every genre.
With a retreat from the realities of day-to-day life in 2011.
But it's interesting that it's going pop. It's going mainstream, all of that hypnagogic stuff.
Mm. I find it intriguing that it's definitely been adopted. I mean, the one thing you've got to say about R&B as a genre is someone new comes along with something good, they jump on it pretty, you know what I mean? The big stars do not, you know, spend any time going, oh, is this really feel? It's like, no, get them in, come on, you produce the dream, in you come, mate. Anyway, next, number two on the list. Katie B, whose album On A Mission is number two in our Album of the Year list. It's been nominated for a bunch of awards. Again, I think she's had the benefit of there not being that many amazing pop records for people who like that kind of thing to converge around. But I will say this, there's been a lot of dubstep influence. It's the other thing that all those kind of pop rappers or whatever do, as well as making records that sound like rave thing, is they have a track. They have tracks with bass lines that go... And it's not done very well. And she... clearly is working with people that understand dubstep. She understands it. She understands how to assimilate it into pop music. I think it's a really good album. And, you know, and I don't really like things like Chasing Status. I don't really like Nero and all that kind of, you know.
I was very fond of Magnetic Man. And as a result, KTB, you know, I got to KTB through Magnetic Man and really, really enjoyed it. Desperately wanted to write about her earlier this year. Didn't really get a chance to. But, I'm surprised it's that high. I mean,
I'm surprised it's that high.
Talked about people rallying around, you know, pop releases. So that's very much a rally record. But I think she's got this weird kind of girl next door innocence coupled with the fact that, you know, she's done some pretty big clubbing in her time.
Yeah, I bet she's a right laugh on a night out.
I've been to her twice, lovely.
I should mention the reason why it's so high. One of the reasons why it's so high. A lot of people did vote for it, but we had a lot of younger writers who just started writing for the Guardian's music site, and they all put that in their top three. People like Sean Rowe or Kieran Yates or Sam Wolfson.
Yeah.
So it's quite a generational split.
I think that's good. That's the way pop music should be. And you know what I mean? It's I really like the idea that there's stuff in this list that's young people have put in there. But no, the younger writers have put in there that older writers wouldn't, you know what I mean? And it's not just
people all voting for the same thing.
Yeah. Which brings us to PJ Harvey. There is not an enormous amount, I think, to say about PJ Harvey's Let England Show that hasn't been said already. Kitty, you wrote about it.
In fact, when I sat down to write about it for this poll, I very much wanted to not just rehash all of the timeliness of it, all of the...
tell you what, weirdly prescient, though. That's all this sort of England street, you know, this sort of post-apocalyptic riot strewn streets of England. Whoa.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the idea of land in this album is really quite... Obviously, it's about conflict, but it's also about actual soil and actual landscapes being blown up. It's about copses of trees. It's about trenches. There's a couple of moments in this album where you just feel that men's folly is just this fleeting, idiotic thing, and the land just copes with it and comes back again, and yet the seasons change. And I think that's a very rural point of view, and I think the fact that she grew up on a farm in Dorset is pretty pertinent to that kinship with land. And she talked a lot about soil on her previous album, White Chalk. So I think that's a theme that perhaps has not been discussed quite so much as all the political stuff.
Yeah, you can see why people have discussed the political stuff more. But yeah, it is an album that, as you say, is rooted in the countryside, which makes it kind of fairly unique. I think if we look at this list, they're urban with a small U, a lot of these albums, aren't they? I mean, they're not, these are not...
without a doubt. Without
pastoral,
a doubt.
With the possible exception of King Creosote. Actually, these are all kind of and Fleet Foxes, of course.
Mm. I mean, there's been a lot of folk about, and this is a folk album that's completely nothing like, say, Laura Marling, or completely nothing like Mumford and Sons. It's got an ancientness to it.
It has certainly. That's an interesting point. It has something about it, though. It doesn't sound anything like it, that ties it into traditional English folk, and it doesn't, you know what I mean, it's certainly not pushing the kind of hey nonny no angle or
absolutely
anything
not,
like that,
no.
But yeah, I totally get that, and I had sort of felt that and hadn't thought it, that in some ways you can link it to whether it's the Copper family or the Watersons or any of those kind of like traditional singers. There's something about, maybe it's the combination of writing about current events, which folk music always did, and writing about, as you say, land, the soil, the earth, which is always going to be, you know, it was always a major theme in English folk music because so many people lived off the land.
And also, we have to talk about PJ Harvey's voice for a second here, because I think a lot of people who are not fans find it quite difficult to deal with that voice. I don't know what other people think.
I've never considered it that difficult to...
I didn't enjoy White Chalk as much because I didn't like that.
The soprano.
I mean, I'm a big PJ Harvey fan, but as muso as this sounds, I did prefer the earlier albums because I liked that kind of Steve Albini grungy feel, and I found her voice very difficult on White Chalk.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this album, there's a couple of tracks where she's kind of warbling in a very uncomfortable place in her range.
I think she's doing it deliberately.
And I think, no, I'm agreeing with you, I think she's doing it deliberately, but I think for people coming to this fresh and are going, they're sort of going, a little bit. But
I can understand why. There's also things on it like, what's the track that's got the hunting horn that's completely out of tune and out of time with everything else?
Yeah, and I think those little surprises and the fact that she's got some reggae on there as well, and she's got, I can't remember which obscure country the woman who is singing comes from.
Dorset.
No, the... Oh, she's like a Kazakhstani woman. Yeah, there's a sample. I'm completely failing in my duty as a music journalist to remember these facts. But no, there's a lot of incursions from unexpected sources in this. Using Mick Harvey as a kind of grizzled old man voice, I think, was also quite inspirational on that record. And they just, I don't know, it just gels on so many levels. We're almost slightly apologetic about this because we've all talked about this record so much, I think, over the year and bigged it up. And I mean, are there any dissenting voices around the table? Is there anyone going, very good. It's one of those XX type records where there's a churn of inevitability to this number one.
Let me put that question to you in another way, Rebecca. Is it a record you admire rather than enjoy?
Yes, I would say that's almost exactly it. I admire it. And I really enjoyed, there was a brilliant moment when she was on the Andrew Marr show this year when they were talking about whether David Cameron liked it or not. And he said, you know, something like, well, Samantha bought it. And it was just really uncomfortable, which I quite enjoyed. But yes, I admire it. I think you can see that a lot of work's gone into it. But it's just not, that's not the kind of PJ Harvey music that I like when I go back and listen to things like Rid of Me and Dry. That's what I like.
Fantastic. That's absolutely fair enough. Well, look, before we go, I'm going to put a quick question to all three of you. Anything you thought should have been in that top 50 that wasn't, that was cruelly edged out by Mr. Stetson? Tim, let's start with you.
To be honest, not really. There's albums I put in my top 10, which aren't here, and I suppose in a way you could say, well, that means they should be, but I don't...
What, is it going to stand one?
Well, like, Anna Calvi's album isn't in the top
50. Oh, that's quite a surprise, isn't it?
I tell you what is surprising, what albums didn't turn up in here, which you might have expected to. It's quite surprising that Adele...
Where's the Adele album? I know, that was... I was about to say that. Where's the Adele album?
The world is suffering... Well, I say the world is suffering from Adele fatigue. Mm. She sold 80,000 copies of that album last week. That's 80,000 people have gone out to the shops and gone, you know what I haven't heard nearly enough of this year? Someone Like You by Adele, I'd better buy that record. But, I mean, I think there's just an element of... You know what I mean? If that album had come out in November or whatever, it probably would be more highly regarded.
Well, maybe it's just
not
a critic's album.
Yeah, I think it's got good songs on it in parts, but I don't think it hangs together as an album. Obviously, the world disagrees with me. But
I find it boring as anything.
The new boring.
Biggest selling album of the century thus far, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. There you go.
And the other one, her first album sold loads this year. It sold far more this year than it ever has before.
Yeah. What other things are on there that we would be surprised that aren't?
Well, I was surprised there was no Tyler, as we've discussed, just because I thought someone would have voted for it. And I suppose maybe that there's no Florence and the Machine at all in the 50s.
Azarian 3. I love Azarian 3's album. Yes.
They're bringing that out again in February, aren't they? It feels like a
that's because
bigger push for it.
I think that's because no one knew whether they could vote for it or not. I like
because
to think,
the single had come out.
Different things have come out for like
different
the last
times.
3 years.
Yeah. But
that is
it's an amazing record.
Lovely record.
And I don't quite the thing I love about it is I don't quite know why it's so good. It's just there's that about 10 years ago there was there used to be a track by Eddie Amador called House Music, and it went, not everyone understands house music. It's a spiritual thing, it's a body thing, it's a soul thing. And there's something indefinable about what makes a brilliant house record, and whatever it is, they have done it. Because it's not a particularly groundbreaking dance record. It sounds, you know, I put it, my wife thought it was made in 1989, you know. But it's just brilliant. Rebecca, what was on there that you... It wasn't on there, rather.
I was surprised Anna Calvi wasn't anywhere on the list. And again, Adele, Tyler, I thought should have been on there. I don't think they should have been on there, but I was surprised
what about
that they weren't on
there. From your own
something
personal collection?
That I'm not at all surprised wasn't on there, but I think wasn't really widely listened because it wasn't really widely listened to. But I really enjoyed Peggy Sue's second album, which came out in Wichita, which they, I think, carry the baggage of people thinking that they're a folk band, but they've made this actually quite influenced by PJ Harvey in the 90s sort of grungy album, and it was produced by John Parrish, and it's a very good record. I think more people should hear it.
Kitty?
I think we've covered the you know, news headlines. Really stunned that Florence isn't somewhere in this list. I was quite near about that album when I wrote about it, but actually... It's not that bad. It's not so bad as to be at 51. Do you know what I mean? So I feel as though I ought to slightly defend Florence and the Machine's ceremonials here briefly, if I may. I think it's very much going to be successful in America, this record, and it, perhaps not at the Adele stage yet, which is quite surprising for this strange kind of Camberwell, you know, art student. I think.
But I think the reason I didn't really take to that album is because I felt like that was so obvious from the sound of it that it was designed to be big in America, which I didn't really. That put me off a little bit, I think.
Yeah, no, quite contrived. Agreed. It did feel contrived. But there are some pretty good tunes on there. And she is, I think her image is fascinating. I think she's rocking the kind of Virginia Woolf thing quite nicely. And I think, you know, we really have perhaps been a bit dismissive.
Interesting, controversial point on which to end. Thank you very much for coming to this week's programme, all three of you. We'll be back next Friday. You can read the whole 50 Albums of the Year list and leave your reviews. The links are all at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. Thank you, Rebecca, Tim and Kitty, and thank you for listening. I'm Alexis Petridis. The programme was produced by Scott Cawley.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.